Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. The Soapbox has some great news. We're going to be uploading our shows to the Pacifica Network affiliate starting soon. So we're going to have a new format. The show's only going to be a half hour from now on. So today we're going to start with our new format, a half hour show. It's going to consist of an interview with a fabulous person every week, and our first show on Pacifica will be our interview with President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. So we're really looking forward to that, and we're really looking forward for you to help support us, as you've always been supporting us this past year or so, to call your local Pacifica affiliate, if you have one, to encourage that they put Cindy Sheehan Soapbox on the air. Today's guest is constitutional lawyer Glenn Greenwald. Well, Glenn, it says, is a former constitutional lawyer and civil rights attorney, and he is now an author of three books, and he blogs at salon.com. So, Glenn, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Oh, it's so great to have you on. I've long been a reader of your work, and I really admire it, and I learn a lot from it. But before we get started, I want to talk about the presidential assassination program for American citizens overseas. But before we get started, you know, you're an expert on constitutional law and civil rights, and I am not, but, you know, I'm regularly on the street getting arrested trying to stick up for our rights, especially particularly our First Amendment rights. But what, and this is a constant discussion we have in the peace and justice movement, do we even have a constitution left? Can the Constitution and the USA Patriot Act and the FISA Modernization Act coexist? Do we have the rule of law still in the USA?
Well, it's a good question. The idea, of course, of the Constitution was that it would be the last resort to limiting government power and preventing tyranny in the United States. The idea of it was that it's really just a document that does nothing other than place limits on what people in political power can do, and there, the president has an oath to abide by it, and Congress takes an oath to abide by it, and ultimately, when they violate it, as they frequently do, the responsibility lies with the courts to enforce those limitations, and then when the courts fail, ultimately, the last line of defense are the people, and both Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and others have said that. Certainly, since 9/11, there has been a very aggressive rollback of constitutional liberties based on the idea that when we're at war, in essence, the Constitution is suspended. And although the courts, for the first several years after 9/11, much to their eternal shame, were very deferential to those theories and deferential to overreaching on the part of the government, they've slowly begun to place limitations on presidential power. They've ruled that military commissions without congressional approval are unconstitutional. They ruled that denying habeas corpus to Guantanamo detainees is unconstitutional. They place limits on what the government can do in terms of how it detains U.S. citizens. But these, in the context of what's taken place, these limitations are fairly modest, and you're certainly right that the way our government operates in so many ways transgresses with constitutional limitations, and it's really up to the courts and ultimately the people to take a stand and prevent that from happening.
Well, it's just very difficult because it seems like there is no checks and balances, and I've been arrested now in Washington, D.C., I think about 12 or 13 times, and there's three different jurisdictions in Washington, D.C., and I mostly get arrested by the park police. But it seems like every time we get arrested for the same thing, they change the rules or they change the fines or, you know, they totally ignore our rights as U.S. citizens, whether it's a First Amendment right or a Fourth Amendment right or whatever. And it seems like they can just arbitrarily change things now. You know, for example, do you know anything about the case of Dr. Afia Siddiqui?
The Pakistani neuroscientist who was just convicted in federal court?
Right, and so we're, as American citizens, aren't we guaranteed the right to a trial of our peers. But then Dr. Afia was brought, she's a Pakistani citizen, brought to America and tried in a federal court. It just seems like there is no rhyme or reason or rules that anybody is following anymore.
Well, I think, you know, that's by and large an accurate critique. I mean, as I suggested a little bit earlier, the most of our institutions, our leading institutions, including the ones that are principally charged with safeguarding constitutional liberties, have adopted this mindset that because we are at war, and of course the war that we're fighting is not just the war in Afghanistan or Iraq, according to our government, those are sort of traditional wars, it's this endless, amorphous war that will have no end, that's fought on every inch of the earth, and that's fought against a tactic that will exist forever in perpetuity, and therefore the war will as well. And our institutions have adopted the idea that the threats that are raised by this war are so severe and profound that, in essence, anything goes. And there are all sorts of judges, particularly in Washington and New York, who have become convinced that it's vital to let the government essentially make up whatever rules they want as they go along in the name of security and fighting terrorism and keeping public order. And this has spilled over into other realms as well, as tyrannical mindsets always do. It's now not just terrorism, but in drug prosecutions and even petty crimes of the type that you're describing, where clearly people who have a First Amendment right to protest and to assemble are being prosecuted without any real limitations whatsoever. The most they're allowed is to sit in a so-called free speech zone, which is really a cage far removed from where they can have an impact, and you're right, it's really become quite pervasive in our institutions, most dangerously in the institutions that are designed to safeguard these liberties. And I think you've seen, as I said, some judges stepping up and reversing some of these things, but not fast enough and not enough at all.
Okay, well, let's get to the real reason that I wanted to interview you, is because I think out of any of the other writers, you've been really on the subject of this presidential assassination program. And I was in front of the CIA a couple weeks ago. They're protesting the extrajudicial assassination of Pakistani citizens by drone bombing in the CIA. And now, come to find out, we actually have troops on the ground in Pakistan. No declared war. We're not fighting any declared war anywhere, Glenn. You know, we had some kind of authorization to use military force that wasn't supposed to be open-ended to just, like, you know, run roughshod over the world like you just pointed out. So we were protesting these extrajudicial killings of Pakistani citizens, where the CIA actually has made itself the judge, jury, and executioner of these people. There's no due process or a fair or transparent. There's no transparency at all in this. And so recently we found out that the executive branch has taken authority to assassinate American citizens outside the country.
It's really quite amazing. One amazing aspect of it is how little attention and controversy that revelation
absolutely
has
generated. That's what's amazing to me, is that, you know, it hasn't received a blip on the radar screen when, you know, we're supposed to care more about Toyota than our own government taking this, you know, power on itself. And what is even more amazing to me is I did see a news report about it on Press TV, and I think four out of the five people that were just American citizens asked about the program said, well, you know, if the government says they need to be killed, I guess they need to be killed.
Yeah, well, that's the attitude. I mean, if you think about it, what's really striking about it is if you look at some of the controversies of the Bush years, what Democrats and liberals objected to vehemently was the idea that the Bush administration was eavesdropping on the telephone conversations of American citizens without warrants, without judicial oversight. I mean, I objected to that vehemently as well. And yet here you're talking about not the government eavesdropping on American citizens without warrants or without any judicial oversight. You're talking about the U.S. government targeting them for murder, for assassination, for killing, without any oversight and without any warrants. And I guess because there's a Democratic president in office now, the Democrats and progressives who are so upset at mere eavesdropping on American citizens now find this to be acceptable. And you know, it's one thing if there's an active battlefield and there's a war zone and there's a declared war, which the Constitution requires. Then obviously if an American citizen joins a foreign army and is fighting on an active battlefield against the U.S. military, obviously the U.S. military has the same right to shoot at and kill a foreign soldier in a war, in a real war, declared war, a legal war, than they do a foreign soldier. It's because they're an American soldier that joining a foreign army doesn't give them any special protections. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about are people who are far away from any battlefield, who are in places where there is no declared war, there's no active war zone like Yemen, where we're targeting American citizens. People who are in their homes sleeping, walking on the street, riding in a car with their family, who are being murdered by the U.S. government, their own government, with drone attacks or other missile assaults. I mean, you could just read the Fifth Amendment. It says no person shall be deprived of life without due process of law. It just says it in as clear a language as possible. And yet here we are with the administration admitting that it claims the power to target American citizens for assassination with no oversight, no judicial approval, nothing, no charges, no evidence brought, no opportunity to defend themselves, and there's barely a whisper. And what's most amazing about it is it's not just an abstract claim that the administration is making. They have a list of American citizens, many of whom we don't know, one of whom we do know, who they've been trying to kill and have been shooting missiles at and sending drone attacks after. And if we don't object to the president claiming the right to assassinate American citizens without any judicial approval, what do we object to?
Well, you know, that's exactly the cool. Well, first of all, people need to know about it. I don't think very many people know what is happening because we, of course, already pointed out the lack of media attention about this. Mm-hmm. But talk about, first of all, there's two things, I think, happening here. There's the what you call the war exception to the Constitution, and then the literal practice of these assassinations and attempted assassinations. So in a recent article I read that you wrote on Common Dreams, you argue that there is no war exception to the Constitution.
Right. Well, there is no war exception to the Constitution. You can read the entire Constitution from start to finish, and there is nothing in there about how any of the rights or liberties get suspended in time of war. The only exception is that the habeas corpus right can be suspended by Congress only when there's an invasion or a rebellion, and Congress hasn't suspended that right. There hasn't been an invasion of the United States. There's no rebellion. But no other right even has a permissible exception in time of war. And, of course, the founders were well aware that we would be a country periodically at war. After all, the country was born as a result of a war against the greatest, then greatest empire on the face of the earth. And this Constitution was intended to limit what the government could do at all times, in times of war and peace, in times of tranquility, and in times of turmoil. And no Supreme Court has ever said that the Constitution gets suspended during times of war, and yet our media class and our political class and many citizens will justify constitutional abridgment by saying, well, we're at war, so these things need to take place or are justifiable. It's a complete myth. It's like the population has been ingrained to believe that the minute our leaders utter the word war, the Constitution no longer applies and they're permitted to do whatever it is that they want. And in this case, it's particularly pernicious given, as we discussed earlier, the fact that this war is going to be, by all accounts, more or less permanent. So if you're somebody who believes that the Constitution is suspended during time of war, you're essentially saying that the Constitution in the United States no longer exists. The other aspect of it is that we have had a government, first under the Bush administration, now the Obama administration, that has been wrong on so many instances where they claim that people were terrorists. Several hundred people at least who have gone through Guantanamo ended up being guilty of absolutely nothing and were released. Federal courts, ever since the Supreme Court in 2008 said they had that Guantanamo detainees have the right to habeas corpus, have looked at Guantanamo cases 39 times, and 33 of the 39 times, they found that there was no evidence to justify the accusations and ordered the detainees released. So the last thing that we ought to do is trust our government when it says the people that we are accusing are terrorists, and therefore we can put them in a cage without a trial or murder them, because they've proven that many, many times, either through error or abuse or something worse, they're simply wrong. The accusations are simply false. And yet many, many people will say, well, it's okay for us to kill these people or put them in cages because they're terrorists. And what they really mean is the government has accused them of being terrorists, but we should all learn in the fifth grade that an accusation by the government of guilt is not the same thing as establishing guilt, and yet we've seemed to have forgotten that principle.
Well, how many times just in our history, since we are the only quote-unquote civilized country left that has the death penalty, how many times have we executed innocent people who have had trials and have been able to go through the appeals process? How many innocent people have we executed that way?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, everybody agrees, even including the most vociferous death penalty proponents, that we have executed a large number of people who were completely innocent. And as you said, that's after they've been charged with the crime, they've been put through a full jury trial and given multiple appeals. I mean, there are all sorts of procedural protections in place before somebody can be executed in the United States. And despite all those protections, we continue to execute innocent people for all sorts of reasons. And here you're talking about killing people who have had no trial whatsoever. They take the case of the American cleric, Anwar al-Awlaki, who's in Yemen and who has been alleged to have encouraged the Fort Hood shooter and the Christmas Day bomber. He is in hiding, but his family says that he is guilty of none of those things. He vehemently denies being a member of al-Qaeda. All we know is that the government has accused him of those things, and yet many people, Democrats or Republicans alike, are cheering on our attempt to kill him. He was an American citizen, every bit as much as you or I. He was born in the United States, raised in the United States, full American citizenship, and yet for many people, even in the face of all those errors that we've made, as you say, not just in the terrorism context, but even with full due process, the claim, the mere accusation by the Obama administration that this person is a terrorist is enough for people to cheer, kill him, about their fellow citizen. It's very disturbing and pernicious.
Well, you know, it's super disturbing, and like you pointed out in your article, there's no evidence that some of these people have actually acted upon what is their freedom of speech. It's they're just exercising speech, and they haven't. There's no evidence or apparent evidence that they've actually acted upon. Even if there was, they deserve a fair trial. Was it your article I read that pointed out about the case of the Ku Klux Klan member?
Yes, and this is something that a lot of people don't know, but in the United States, under the First Amendment, the Supreme Court has said that you have the right to free speech to essentially express any political idea. When the Constitution says Congress shall make no law abridging free speech, it really means that Congress shall make no law abridging free speech. So, for instance, you have the right even to advocate violence and revolution. There's a 1969 case, Brandenburg versus Ohio, from the Supreme Court, which was unanimously decided, where a Ku Klux Klan member stood up and was surrounded by hooded members of the KKK holding automatic weapons, and he gave a speech threatening violence and vengeance against any Caucasian politicians, as he called them, who continued to suppress the white race. And he threatened violence, and he said, we're at the point where violence is not only justified, but the moral responsibility of white people. A horrible, repulsive speech, but political speech nonetheless. He was prosecuted and convicted by the state of Ohio, and the Supreme Court has said that the First Amendment does not allow people to be prosecuted for expressing even advocacy of violence or revolution. Other members of the Communist Party were similarly prosecuted for advocating revolution in the United States, and they were found to be protected by the First Amendment. And so all we know about this cleric at most is that he says things like, it's the duty of Muslims to attack the United States because, you know, of all the violence that the United States has brought to the Muslim world. You can say that, And not only can't you be, not only do you have the right not to be killed for that, you have the right not to be punished at all. You have the First Amendment right as an American citizen to say that, and yet the only thing the Obama administration has really accused this cleric of doing is exactly that. And not only are they seeking to punish him, they're seeking to murder him. And that's exactly why we require under the Constitution that before the government can accuse somebody and punish them, they have to go to court so that people can raise these defenses, make these arguments, and have a court decide, not have the president decide what kind of punishment is warranted, if any.
Well, if we have a court, you know, we have the courts the way they are now. We have an executive branch that has unprecedented power. And Obama has not, has not given up any of the powers that George Bush, the Bush administration, in their unitary executive theory, took upon itself. And we have a Congress that was complicit when George Bush was president. You know, we had a Democratic Congress for 2 years while George Bush was president. They didn't do anything about reining in his imperial powers then, and now we have an overwhelming Democratic Congress and a Democrat in the executive branch. That, to me, this stuff is terrifying. I mean, as an American citizen that speaks loudly against my government, where does it stop? Does it stop just with assassinating Americans outside of the country, or does it extend to other people who are just extending, who are, exercising their freedom of speech? Should I be worried if I go outside the country that my government is going to assassinate me? So where does it stop? And what can we do if the checks and balances that were set up, and of course the media is supposed to be the fourth estate, it's supposed to also put a check and balance on the government, and that and the corporate media has failed its responsibility. So what can we do?
Well, those are really the core great questions. They're great questions. I mean, you know, I think that a lot of people for a long time thought that the solution was to vote the Republicans out of office and elect a Democrat. And I wasn't one of the people who thought that that would be a solution, but I understand why people did think that, because back during the Bush era, it was the case that these debates tended to divide down more or less along Republican versus Democratic lines. You had roughly 50% of the country cheering for these abuses of executive power, and roughly 50% of the country, with a lot of exceptions, the Democrats who approved of it, but roughly the other 50% who were objecting and making all kinds of accusations against the Republican president. Well, as it turns out, now that we have a Democratic president who's continuing these same policies, the real danger is that there's no longer a division even about these policies. There's no argument anymore about whether we can detain people without charges or make accusations that because we're at war, we can kill people who the president declares to be terrorists. Because now they've become bipartisan policies, and you have Democrats and Republicans alike cheering for military commissions or the denial of civilian trials and the like. And so it's really become an American political consensus within the establishments of the Democratic and Republican Party. Obviously, there's lots of people who continue to object, but the two-party establishments are now on board with the policies. They belong to both political parties, and so they become entrenched as consensus. And that's the real danger, is that Obama's continuation of an embrace of these policies has really strengthened them even more than Bush and Cheney were able to, ever to do, because he's made them, he's removed them from the realm of establishment debate. And so there really is a serious danger now as far as what can be done about it. I mean, there's a two-party dominance in our country, and it's very hard to fight against policies when both parties have embraced them, and I, obviously the ways to do that is for people to continue to stand up and use alternative platforms like you do and like I do on blogs, and people to organize and not be so dependent upon the two-party system, and to have citizen movements to demand a restoration of these constitutional liberties. I mean, ultimately, when all institutions fail, and you're right, they've all failed, including the media, perhaps especially the media, it's up to the citizenry to defend their rights. And if the citizenry isn't willing to do so, then according to Ben Franklin, essentially they deserve to lose those rights. So that's really ultimately the real question.
Well, we're like out of time. This went by so fast. I just have one more question, and then I want you to tell my listeners where they can read your excellent analysis. But when was the last time our Constitution was actually amended in the way that our founders wanted it to be amended?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, probably one of the best examples was the 13th and 14th Amendments, which were really enacted in the wake of the Civil War and as a means of rectifying all of the horrible pre-Civil War decisions that denied full citizenship to what were then slaves and what then became free black citizens. And the Equal Protection Clause, which didn't exist prior to the enactment of the 14th Amendment, as well as the provision in the 14th Amendment that applied all of the amendments to the states and not just to the federal government, were really very impressive examples of the self-corrective aspect of our system of government. The founders knew that they were imperfect and that the document that they wrote was therefore imperfect, and that there would be things that needed to be done in order to fix them. And the 14th Amendment is probably the sterling example, the peak of that. Of course, you know, giving the right to vote to women, the repeal of prohibition, these were all important advancements in our country that corrected real wrongs. And so the amendment process is an important means for an important vehicle for correcting fundamental flaws in our system of government. Unfortunately, it requires a real consensus that doesn't seem possible much longer.
Well, it almost seems because it's an established. It seems like it's an establishment tool. It's not a people's tool.
It's become that. I think you're right.
And so everything that has brought us up to date is basically just the government usurping power and the people letting it go where it becomes a custom and not a law.
Right. I think the problem is that the citizenry has really been trained to accept their own impotence and their own helplessness. It just seems to people that the forces that are arrayed against them, the massive amounts of money and corporate power and the distant centralized federal government that operates without limits, has really made it, in their minds, impossible to do much about it, and they've acquiesced and withdrawn, and that's why you see barely 50% of the public even bothering to vote any longer. That's a real sign of a sickness on the part of the electorate that they've come to accept their own impotence, and I think that's, you know, probably the first and most important problem.
Well, thank you again, Glenn, for being on the show, and I'd like to have you on again really soon, speaking of corporate power, to talk about United Citizens versus the federal election system, federal election commission. If you want to come back on pretty soon and talk about that, because that, you know, talk about the corporate power and the extension of corporate power with that decision is another. I think it's a case that's going to go down in a, you know, U.S. history, the same as Marbury versus Madison or something, to be a very important decision, important and destructive.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I'm an admirer of everything you've done, and I'm happy to come back anytime.
Oh, thanks, Glenn. Tell my listeners where they can read your blogs.
It's at salon.com, and you can just find my name and click on it there.
Oh, thank you for being on the show, Glenn. Hope to talk to you soon.
My pleasure, Cindy. Thanks.
That was author Glenn Greenwald. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. I'd like to thank, as always, my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my producer, Mikey, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, you for listening, and Glenn for coming on the show. So I hope you tune in next week. Thank you. This is Cindy Sheehan. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.